You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 229 is Peter Halsapple, best known for his work in the early 80s with the band The DBs. You're right now hearing their biggest hit, Amplifier, from their second album, 1981's Repercussion. He had had a long connection before that with his DBs co-frontman Chris Stamey, who I've had on the show before. The two co-fronted the band for the first two albums. Peter fronted it by himself for another two albums. The fifth album was unreleased until 1994, by which time Peter had become an auxiliary member of REM on their world tour for Green and then the Out of Time album recording. He similarly supported Hootie and the Blowfish for many years. In 1991, he recorded the first of a few different reunion projects with Chris Stamey and joined the Continental Drifters as one of three or four singer-songwriters through their four albums. He has released only three solo albums to date, the first being in 1995, and we're going to discuss songs from the other two. The song Larger Than Life comes from The Face of 68, his brand new album. Then Don't Mention the War is from Game Day 2018. And then we'll discuss She Won't Drive in the Rain by the DBs from their reunion album 2012's Falling Off the Sky. Finally, we'll hear Where Does the Time Go by Continental Drifters from Better Day, their last album, 2001. You can read about his various activities at halfpairblog.blogspot.com. Learn more about this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will have played a little bit of Amplifier by the DBs from Repercussion 1981. The most funky thing, maybe the biggest early hit that you had. We're going to get pretty quickly to the new album, The Face of 68. Is there something short? I will already recorded a little intro. You know, your sporadic solo albums in between, getting back together with Chris a few times, and the DBs reunion, and the Continental Drifters, of course. And I remember reading an article by you in the New York Times, something about how, in the early teens, I think, or something, about how you're no longer being a full-time musician, and it's just not even possible for people to do that anymore in this day and age. Can we say something about the shape of your career, given those milestones?
Well, you know, it has been a long row to hoe. I first made it a record in 1972, and I'm now doing a record in 2025. So that's a fair amount of cover of time. I like to think of my music as stuff that just kind of arises organically from me. So sometimes it'd be appropriate songs for the DBs. Sometimes it would be appropriate songs for the Drifters. Sometimes it would be something for me and Chris. But I just keep writing. I've written since I was about 8 years old. I've written songs since I was about 8 years old. They weren't very good songs at eight. But, I mean, I don't know too many people who, I mean, other than Mozart, who probably weren't very good at eight. Life has changed for me, and so the songwriting has changed. The methodology has changed. The results have certainly changed. I was thinking the other night, it's a good thing I'm not writing the same songs I was writing when I was in my 20s. It wouldn't serve very well. I would just basically say I stalled somewhere along the line. But I like to write different types of songs. The exciting part to me about The Face of 68 is the fact that these songs are almost like a tribute to the pre-Big Star Halsapple. Because when Big Star came along in 1972, which was also the same year as the Rittenhouse Square record with Mitch Easter and Chris Stamey, that was a kind of a heavy record. I don't know if you've ever wasted any time on YouTube listening to it, but it's heavy. And we were listening to that kind of stuff at that time. We were playing a lot of double guitar stuff. And so that was how I was writing up until we heard Big Star, and then suddenly the switch flipped and it all changed. And, you know, that's where the specter of power pop arose. So in an attempt to make a record that really had not a lot of characteristics of other records that I've made, specifically DB's records and Continental Drifters records, I think I really succeeded with this record because it is a loud guitar record. It's a guitar, bass, drums oriented record with vocals, obviously. But it doesn't have, you know, there's not all that sort of wash of 12-string electrics and angelic voices. It's pretty straightforward, and it's about loss, and it's about humor. One song's about love. That's another thing. I sort of shifted gears a little with the subject matter, and, you know, again, the 20-year-old would be writing, "Oh, my girlfriend left me, boo-hoo." When the record was being made, the late 60s guy, literally and figuratively, was not going to write that kind of song. Those lyrics would have not been what I would do.
Yeah, probably if your baby leaves you at that age, it's a little different. There's not that many more fish in the sea in the same way. Anyway, that's a...
Dear God, I hope my baby doesn't leave me. You know, at this point, I'm not sure how I'd manage, but I'm sure I'd find a way.
Do we have a few words to say about Larger Than Life, in particular, the first single that was released late last year, before we hear it in full?
Sure. Larger Than Life was the song that made me think I should do another solo record. It was a song about the death of my friend Carlo Nucio, who was the drummer and founder of the Continental Drifters. He died a couple of years ago from cancer, and he was easily the most inspirational musician I ever played with. He left a big hole in the community when he died, and my way of grieving is to write a song. And so I wrote this song. This all kind of came at once, hence trustworthy song in my book. The ones that all come together with the lyrics and the music at the same time are usually kind of a good sign something is happening. I think we're going to talk about another one of those songs on your program here. But it all came together. When it did, I thought, well, gosh, it's been 7 years since I did Game Day. I think the statute of limitations is over, and you know, I could probably do something again. And so I started listening to the songs I'd done. And that was the kind of cornerstone, Larger Than Life. And from that, I found a lot of songs, and they were mostly loud guitar, bass, and drums kind of songs. And I thought, well, we could put something together with a record. So I see that as the key to the door.
Stronger than death, diminished yet unfinished, beyond the last step. Surrounded yet unbound by corporeal self. Larger than life, stronger than death. Wrapped in the night, bathed in a light. A sign, or is it all by design, or just larger than life? A blanket of love, wherever above, make it larger than life, and you can be, cause you're always around, we can hear your sound. Scuttle by window outside, on your way to where you're as free as you were. Breathe in the sky like you used to do, before the sky got the better of you. The power of time to marginalize, make it larger than life and not regular size. But there's a candle a day, the sorrow at bay. When it's larger than life, is it better that way? Never really that far apart. What's that scratching at my heart? Slot, vibrate with all you got, and every turn and move like an ever-widening groove. Like a chill in the air, you are everywhere, making it larger than life and harder to breathe. please send us a sign. Is it all by design, or just larger than life? Never really that far apart. What's that scratching at my heart? Never really that far apart. What's that scratching at my heart? Never really that far apart. What's that scratching at my
I knew there was something about somebody who had died. Now I'm quickly reinterpreting all the lyrics that I'm looking at in light of the details you've just provided. So yeah, once you get this out, I mean, yes, you were larger than life. You had this presence that is, you know, has now created a vacuum in which grief rushes in. But then once you've got that out, it seems like you've got enough verses. You can play with this image a little bit such that we're talking about sort of your own sorrow that is the thing that's larger. Anyway, can you, any thought about just how this develops from an idea, a single image through an actual sequence of, I don't know, were there more verses written for this originally, or was this is it? This is how it came out.
The bulk of the song's lyrics came at once. There were earlier lyrics to the music that just weren't hanging very well. So I junked those and I started over. And every article celebrating Carlo after he died used the term larger than life, or most of them did, certainly. And it's absolutely the case. He was actually life size, and cancer really proved that. So that was the one thing that he was not larger than life over. And so the hole he's left is larger than life. His presence emanates from whatever other side there is. I have conversations with Carlo all the time. I think a lot of his friends probably do. I think it's like his work's not done. He's still got to rattle the cage once in a while. So yeah, I do want to know what's it all about, if he's got some clue from the other side. I would love to know it. But it is a lot of my missing my friend terribly, my missing my conversations with him, my missing my musical relationship with him. Well, we played together in a lot of different groups besides the Continental Drifters. He sort of made me put a band together of a trio down in New Orleans, and he played in this band that I had in Los Angeles, you know, doing my songs. And he played drums on my first solo record. He was everywhere, you know. He made sure he was everywhere. He made sure he was in your face. And so I think that when somebody like that leaves, it's sort of like, this is a kind of a stupid analogy, but the idea of when you move furniture that's been in a place for a long time, and you can still see where the light in the house bleached the wood around the shadow of it. So he's still there, you know, the little imprints in the carpet, he's still there. So I see it as mourning the loss of him and celebrating his larger-than-lifeness that makes him alive today in so many ways. That's the best I can say for explaining the gist of that song.
Well, just the fact that it's a song about mourning that is so jumpy and catchy, you know, it's not quite to the point of amplifier, but I got a similar, since we just heard that intro, that this intro, I mean, it stays on this on one chord rather than going between the chords, but it still has a similar danceable, not quite danceable, but something like that. It's a good groove that I guess was saying more about him and his style and his presence, you know, literally as a drummer.
He was one of the best drummers in New Orleans. And so it made sense to have a song that would shake you like a drummer would. the funny thing is that the drummer on The Face of 68 is Rob Ladd. And Rob is an old friend from North Carolina. He was the drummer for a band called the Pressure Boys, a very influential new wave sort of band. And then he went out to LA and he played with all sorts of people like Alanis Morissette and Don Henley. And then he moved back to North Carolina and he played with the Red Clay Ramblers, one of the famous folk artists in the Chapel Hill area. And he played with Don Dixon for years on and off, which is where I really got to hear him a lot. And the funny thing is, I'm getting back around to this, is when Carlo left the Continental Drifters under the unfortunate circumstances of us having to ask him to leave because his issues were getting in the way of our performances and getting along with each other. He got all that straightened out eventually. But when he left, I had just been on the road with Hootie and the Blowfish, and Dixon and Rob Ladd and the guitar player Jamie Hoover had been on tour with us. And I was listening to Rob Ladd play every night, and I was thinking, my God, this guy is funky. And I thought, maybe he would be the guy for the Continental Drifters. So I said, Drifters, I've got a guy. You know, we did some rehearsals before, just learning songs without a drummer, without a Carlo, you know, with that big larger than life hole in the band. Can the band go on without this guy who is the face of the band? And we did, you know, because we were all realized that we were faces of the band. So we got, I said, we should try Rob Ladd. And we called him out and he came out and he played with us. He did some recording with us, did a couple of gigs. It didn't work. We got Russ Broussard, who did work and was our drummer for so many years. But I think it's really funny that I've got Rob playing on a song about the guy he replaced in the Drifters briefly. It's not like a Drifters beat. You know, it's not like a funky New Orleans beat. It's got the chug of a shovel. It's just like regular repeat, repeat, repeat.
So is there anything Carlo relevant in using the little... Sounds like spoons, spoon percussion that's filling the little holes in the intro. And
I don't know. You'd have to ask Dixon. I think that was put on after the fact.
Okay. So this was not something you ordered. Obviously, it's very stripped down, the whole arrangement, that it's basically a three piece, you know, so that you got just a little bit of sweetening here and there. We got harmonizing yourself. Well, especially, yeah, here, you know, when you build to the three-part harmony, surrounded yet unbound by a corporeal self, that almost has like a, you know, 8 miles high sort of 60s. I guess we're talking about the incorporeal. We can get a little trippy here. Any thoughts about just how, obviously, most of it's very grounded and you don't actually turn the reverb all the way up. Just that choice, for instance, to do the lead guitar is just being mostly that one note, such that when you have a solo, well, let's do that one note. Two guitars are doing it at the same time. Just that sort of minimalist treatment.
It was important to make this record as quickly as I could for budgetary reasons and also for the desire to have something kind of immediate. And so I had sent the demos that I did for songs for the record around to Rob and our bass player, Robert Sledge, and also to Don Dixon, who I wanted to produce the record. And everybody was agreed that the arrangements were pretty steadfast as they were. And that was great because that saved a lot of time. We went into the studio without having actually sat in a room playing the songs together. We just went in and basically rolled tape, even though it isn't rolling tape anymore. Although at this studio, you can now roll tape again because they got their 24-track, 2-inch Studer machine operational, which is very nice. Who can afford the tape? So this is all done in Pro Tools, obviously. But we wanted to make something that was presentable as a three-piece kind of band. If that was the way I was going to promote it, I wanted to make it presentable as songs played on an acoustic and a vocal with nothing else. I think that that worked also, even though there's nothing like that on there. These songs do reduce very nicely to the single. You know, again, if it works like that, it's probably a good song. If you have to have all the bells and whistles to make it sound right, well, you better have a budget for bells and whistles. That's all I can say. But I think that the harmonies that are kind of rising sort of represent the distance between me and the afterlife, almost like stairs to him, to see over the side, to talk with him. And, you know, they're infrequent. They don't always go to the third harmony. Sometimes it's just the two. I'm a big fan of two-part harmony and a guy who really doesn't like three-part harmony very much. But because this song was as stripped down and as dark chordally as it was, it helps to have a little bit of lightness in the upper register with the vocals. And since I was doing all the harmonies to myself, I could hit the top of that and not be hurting. So that was good. I try to find the right parts for the song. I try to think about that. You know, my last solo record, I did all the parts myself with the exception of some trombone on one or two songs. And so I can do it, but I discovered that doing it with a rhythm section and a producer comes out with a far different sounding and a better sounding record if you want to get something immediate. I mean, I could sit in my studio where you're talking to me now, and I could just like load up track after track after track. It reaches a point of diminishing returns. It's like, how do you know that the song is finished? How do you know an album is finished? This way, we knew this is what we're setting out to do. We're going to record 11 songs. We have 4 days to do it. And that doesn't count the mixing, but we have 4 days to get basic tracks, lead vocals, and overdubs using the consistency of the microphones at the studio. And by God, we got it done in 3.5. So to me, that is the beauty of a really great functional unit of musicians and technicians. We had a great engineer, Jason Richmond, who comes with the studio and knows his way around there and was able to sit with Dixon in the control room while the rest of us are out in the room facing each other, just playing. We didn't even stick the drums in an isolation room. We just played it. It was great. I've not done stuff like that very much. It's, I come from a background of overdub to death. And overthink to death. Is there a hole? You should fill it, right? Because what is the thing? You might as well use all 24 tracks. They're billing it for all of them anyway.
Yeah, I think it sort of depends on what you're going for, especially in a live unit. And I'll point folks at your 2020 live album that, you know, shows you as basically a three piece. I guess there's occasional keyboard on there, but just making it so you can get everything in one earful is perfectly appropriate. But then having the nice studio things with the 12 layers that only on your fifth listen do you hear all the little nuances, that's also nice. So, you know.
Agreed. It really depends on what the songs are and what the artist is. You know, a DB's record has got layers and layers. The Drifters record doesn't necessarily have layers and layers, but there are so many of us in the band, it seems that way anyway. So this is me being really straightforward and me being simple musically, maybe not lyrically always, but, you know, that's my cross to bear. I can't be simple lyrically. I try. That's the key to writing a great country song, is to have something that everybody can understand. And I know that not everybody understands all the words in my songs. That's okay.
Well, let me play the most musically complex bit. Just going into the solo here, really just the cool chord that you hit with the vocals on Heart here. Scratching at my heart. Just that we're going to have this something to zoom up to get to the solo here, so you can violate your simplicity. It's not a blues song, you know, that would not have that in there, that sort of launching.
I'm not even sure what that is, if that's an augmented chord or something like that. It may be.
Was it even a thick chord in the guitar, or was that purely the way the vocals were layered?
No, it's down at the first fret of the guitar. It's the,
okay.
I use it for a bunch of different songs. It's like a 9, maybe, which would be an F9. So I like a passing chord now and then to get me from point A to point Z. It really helps to have that in there. And that one also has that sort of train horn vibe a little bit. You know, that's a lonely sound that I love. It's the sound of a train out in the distance someplace. And so, I mean, I wake up to the sound of the train in the morning. I've learned the 2 long, 1 short, 1 long for the crossings that they're coming up upon. And so that's another reason to have that chord in there. It also works as a nice indiscriminate way to get out of the song too. It's almost like the train is passing. All it needs is a Doppler effect.
Yes, and it's a good release in energy because there's not really a chorus in this song. I mean, what I put as the wrapped in the night, bathed in the light, I guess that's the chorus. It's the B section. But to me, it sounds like, oh, that's the pre-chorus. It's about to get us to the release. But no, the release is just back to the train, right?
Dude, songs do not have to have choruses.
Sure.
I will point, as I always like to, at Gentle on My Mind. which does not really have a chorus. It's got verses, you know, and it doesn't have a bridge, doesn't have a B part. That's all it's got is verses, and that's all it needs, you know. I mean, it just takes you where you need to go. And so a lot of these structures in a song, bridges are bridges, exactly. So you want to get from this part to the other part and make it an interesting conversion into that. Then you got to get back over to the other thing and come out in the sort of prescribed method of writing songs. But I don't know. This just fell together. Like I say, the words, the beat, the guitar part, it was born from the chunky guitar on the bottom for sure.
I think it might be a pre-rock and roll technique to have the refrain, the larger than life, the hook, just be the first thing. Mm-hmm. Like if you're saying, write a song called Larger Than Life. Well, probably the first thing comes out of your mouth is that phrase.
Yeah.
And that just becomes the thing. One of the few bells or whistles is this little xylophone thing, the scuttling by the window outside. And you did a little.
Oh, yeah.
Do you even remember what that, what's that, the keyboard in the corner or what?
Scuttling by the window outside.
It's an overdub that I did at home when I'd listened to the mixes that Dixon had sent already. And I was just thinking, it really needs that little identity in there. That's the sound, you know, that's when the leaves do go by and you hear something outside, even though it's not necessarily melodic like a marimba part. And this, I would say that that is probably something from one of my Pro Tools instrument plugins that I put that on with. And I may have done the thing where I ran the track at half speed so that I could actually execute the part correctly, which you can do digitally, which is very handy. In the old days, you would switch it from 7.5 to 3.75 IPS or 1 7/8 IPS, and then, you know, move it back up. That's the half of the lore of Les Paul's recordings, is all those incredible sped up guitars. For me, it was just like, what's the other thing, the Beatles thing, that the solo that George Martin does? It's on Rubber Soul, maybe, or Revolver. It's the half speed. It's a half speed harpsichord that's
okay,
brought up to speed.
I used to do that on my four track all the time. And also just the thing at the end where you have the guitar, where you're just panning it back and forth, also just reminds me of those. I feel like I don't hear that so much of the, let's make the guitar over here. Oh, now it's wandered over here. Now it's wandered back. It's a nice homespun little thing.
I never mind that. You know, I never mind that sort of stuff. I mean, it's like, I was thinking the other day about one of the singles that I grew up with that was my mom's. And it was a song called The Big Hurt by Miss Toni Fisher. And it's a record that was probably one of the earliest uses of flanging, but it was done with tape flanging. So the whole, this kind of whooshing thing, you would know it from Ichiku Park by the Small Face, if you know that song, mm-hmm. where it just sounds like everything's kind of... People these days would say, oh, that's too much. The effect is too overt, you know, but it's like, sometimes you got to hit people over the head with stuff or they're not going to hear it. You know, you can be as subtle as the day is long. And if nobody hears it.
That would have been perfectly in character here. Just the fact that you do a partial fade, right? That you keep the end guitar up while everything else is fading out. That's when I couldn't do it, you know, a little trickier on four track or something, or, you know, I guess you're programming all the individual things. Cause doing a full fade, that's easy. You just even do that after the mix, but do a everything but one fades.
I've learned how to do that as of a couple of days ago, which is where you put everything, at least on Pro Tools, you take everything except for the instrument that you don't want to fade, and you plus it to an aux track, and you can use that, and you can pull it down. So I was able to do that. I had to change the proportions of a song that was going to be used as a non-LP B-side. And so I was like, well, I asked the mastering guy, what do I do? Do I do this? And he said, well, I just thought if you could move it up. I said, I can't because I've got all these fader moves already programmed in. So the easiest thing was just put it all on an aux track and pull it down 1 dB, and it worked like a charm.
Well, let's get the second song out there, Don't Mention the War. On the whole, this album was you overdubbing everything, right? But this sounds pretty produced. It has the strings, it has... But I see you originally wrote this for the Radio Free Song Club the previous year. It was a single the previous year. You want to say a little about where you were at this point and this song before we hear it?
Yeah, the song version that you're hearing or that you're about to play right now is, in fact, the version that I recorded on the single. And I did that because I wanted to put a record out, and I was getting kind of frustrated. And I had these songs. I've been in the Radio Free Song Club for a few years and had done a CD of some of those songs. And those I did all that stuff myself, and that was fine. But then I decided that I would like to try to go in a studio and cut this. And so I spoke to two of my friends, James Wallace and Mark Simonson, who are local Triangle musicians. Mark is the marimba player for The Old Ceremony, if you know that band, with Django Haskins, very well.
I just had him on the show.
I think he plays with Fancy Gap now, another local band that's doing a lot. But James Wallace had been the drummer and keyboard player, piano player for a band that meant the world to me called Max Indian, who, again, were a local band, and they had done one album. It's really lo-fi, but the songwriting is some of the best that I've ever heard. A guy named Carter Guy, his last name is spelled G-A-J, and he wrote most of the songs. I think he and James arranged everything. They were friends from their teenage years. And I really loved the way that record sounded. I loved the drums on it. And it turns out Mark Simonson played drums on the songs that James Wallace didn't play drums on. So I'm being produced by two drummers. What am I thinking? But they were great. I think Mark played drums while I played guitar, and James played piano on that song. And then we went back and added other stuff. I added an upright bass.
You got some organ.
Mark Dahman is a brass player, and he brought his tuba and did some tuba on it.
Okay, that's what that is. I had French horn sounding thing, but tuba.
No, the tuba. It's actually two tubas. So Mark really gave that somber aspect. And then there was a point where James and Mark played marching snares in the studio. And that was a lot of fun to have that, because we wanted to have that whole sort of vaguely military sound on that. And it turned out great. And we did that at Mark's studio. It was brought to the attention of the folks at Omnivore, and they said, well, why don't you add that as extra tracks? I'm like, why don't I? I mean, I might as well, sure. And so I did. And that's why it ended up on Game Day. But the rest of Game Day was all me playing the instruments except the horns.
Probably our favorite relative of all. Nobody ever told funnier jokes. No one drove longer hauls. He was sweet to Mom and Aunt Penny. He drank beer with my dad. So don't mention the war. Would you wanna go and do that for? They'll tell you those stories that'll make your skin crawl, like they overthinking till half his mind is gone. too mad and too sad to tell jokes anymore. And he takes lots of trips to the liquor store. He passes out on her couch, that's when he dreams. You can tell when he jumps and he curses and screams. And he sweats and he shouts and turns white as a sheet. A couch in his head. So don't mention the war. Would you wanna go and do that for? Hey, he'd always say. And he wasn't much good on electric guitar, but he'd never say no if he wanted to play. Zeppelin and Cream, living the dream. It always sounded all right when we jammed. A guitar in nearly 3 years. I can scarcely recognize the same man. So don't mention the war.
Beautiful video for that too, if you haven't seen that.
Yes, I will link folks to that. I was thinking the band, just because you have organ and piano here, and there's just so much.
Oh yeah,
it's just a very thick sound throughout and a very coherent story. This is exactly what you were talking about at the beginning, that when you pass a certain age, you're not writing little love songs anymore. They have to be stories. They have to have some literary, I don't know, they don't always have to have literary value, but this one definitely does. Yeah, do you want to say a little about, is this a true anecdote, or is this adapted something, or is this imagined? Or
this is a set of lyrics that is made from whole cloth. I mean, it's fiction, but there are a lot of people with their own Uncle Lonnies in their lives that are still suffering from PTSD. And I think it would be preposterous and very pompous of me to try to make anything sort of universal, because I'm always going to be speaking from my own voice. Can't speak for the voice of the general populace. You know, I can only tell you what's kind of incubating in my mind. And this has just been sort of messing with me for a while, because it started, you know, the title, I share the title with the very famous Fawlty Towers sketch from the episode of The Germans, Don't Mention the War. I've heard that often, that expression often, usually in connection with the Fawlty Towers sketch. But I started thinking about it, and I was thinking, what if you were this guy's nephew that loved him and that just had this relationship with him, and then he came back and it was an entirely different person? You're just a teenager, and so you don't really know what's going on. You can't quite figure it out, how this has gotten to be like this. This is a guy that you just loved and admired and adored and had the most fun with and everybody loved, and he didn't make it back in one piece. And I just sort of put my thoughts together and turned it into this family story. And it was good for me to do that. I will say that being in the Radio Free Song Club with a collection of great songwriters that made me have to up my game, we're all turning in a song a month. And it was really neat, because I'd never had to work under that kind of timing thing before. You know, for all my records, by the time the records are ready to be recorded, the songs have already been written and it's sort of assembled, because it takes forever to get between records, I'm afraid. It's not like the Beatles going in there and cutting them every 2 years or every year or twice a year or whatever it was. It just doesn't happen like that for everybody else. That was the Beatles. I'm not the Beatles. So just having this monthly assignment had to make me change how I spent my songwriting time. So I wanted to make interesting songs. I was going to record my versions of them on my Pro Tools setup at home, wherever that may be, you know, or out on the road. Hell, I mixed one song in my car on a camping trip in Chincoteague.
Okay.
Over headphones when everybody was asleep. Not recommended. But like I say, it really upped my game a lot. I think I did 32 songs over the course of the podcast, and I didn't miss a one. I had to sub out one song once for an older track that it hadn't been released, because I didn't have the time to get to it, unfortunately. But overall, it was a lot of songs. I guess it was 32. I can't remember exactly. I wish those programs were still around. I think they're archived somewhere, but hopefully somebody can hear some of these great songs. I got to be on programs with people like Amy Rigby and Peter Blegvad and Robin Holcomb, just all kinds of great songwriters that jumped on and got on there. And I even participated in the show live one time with a backing band with David Mansfield and just amazing players, Dave Schramm. It was a really great experience. But I will say that Don't Mention the War might have been the epic achievement of my writing for that show.
And so was the pace, was that one of the things, and not just age, that would make you turn more literary and not just, what can I interrogate about my own attitudes right now? Which I find, you know, I can't do that often. I could when I was 19, but I don't have a varied enough emotional life to just pull something. Reaching out for a story seems a more natural thing if you want to produce in volume.
Well, I'm not sure. This song, like I say, sprang from the title. Mm. When I mulled the title over, the story started to construct itself. And I knew it had to have some kind of ending that wasn't an ending, that wasn't like, and then he drove the car off the cliff, or, and then he drank himself to death, or something like that. I wanted it to remain evident that there was still an ongoing situation. So I think I got that across with it, too. I don't know. You know, I mean, there's a song I wrote for the Continental Drifters years ago called Daddy Just Wants the Terrain. It's about a 7.5-minute story of a farm family that loses their farm after the drought, and it just kind of goes downhill from there. In that case, yeah, they died. But it's like, you know, people would come up to me after shows and say, I love that song about your daddy. And I was like, that's not my dad. I just wrote it. So sometimes you can shift into fictional mode, and if you can, it's a good thing. I've got another song. I got a new song that's sort of like that too. It's a ghost story. And I had to kind of figure out how to do it, and I did it, you know. I mean, like I say, I like different types of songs. I personally like different types of songs. I like writing different kinds of songs myself too. It keeps me on my toes.
I like the movement where you bring in classic rock and you can even have some of your guitar licks kind of illustrate it, much like the xylophone did, or, you know, that patch did in the previous song. Something not necessary for the story, but just to make this vivid of what this person used to be, and, you know, a concrete thing that has been lost, and just bring in a very vivid way.
Yeah, you have to show the different ways the loss manifests itself. It helps to set up what he was, because if you don't know what he was, he would just be a sad guy coming back from the war. But to see the vibrant guy that meant so much to all the family members, that's huge, you know? That makes the descent even further and faster and harder.
Let me play a little section. It's these little stings that you add on guitar after some of the lines. I don't think it actually happens to line three. Let's listen to a few lines here.
That's when he dreams. You can tell when he jumps and he curses and screams. And he sweats and he shouts and turns white as a sheet. And he gives off a smell that's like old rotten meat.
Yeah, so this is the bridge with the tubas. Yeah, any thoughts about putting that together in those particular poignant guitar stings there that are responding to lines?
I feel like those guitar parts are kind of the warping of the situation, a continual warpage that gets more frequent, that gets more pronounced in the behavior of the subject of the song. And so I'm just trying to represent more of that. You know, I mean, some people in this world have got music running through their heads all the time. Some of it sounds like that. Some of it, I'm sure, sounds like Eugene Chadbourne. Some of it sounds like Rafe Vaughan Williams. You know, you just don't know. And so for Uncle Lonnie, the sound is a combination of guitars and fighter jets and terrible things that he can't escape. So even to the point of the guitar playing that he used to do with his nephew, you know, here's the guitar, play it. Why don't you play it? He wants to play it with you. Play with your nephew and you're not going to want to do it. So any number of different levels on that.
Yeah, that's a really good climax to that song. And adding the smell.
Yeah.
And adding this, I guess that's the first place the marching snare comes out, is right at the end of that, where you sort of have a pause and you hear this thing that also comes back at the end of the song.
I didn't want the marching drums to be overwhelming because I thought that would be just, again, it's that fine line between subtle and overt. I thought if it's in there and somebody hears it, then my job is done. If it's in there and everybody hears it, then it's too loud.
I mean, yeah, it's subtle there. At the end of the song, it's less so. It reminded me a little of the, you know, the Roger Waters, the Final Cut / The Wall. He's done it in like four different albums where he brings in little war sounds and things because people are haunted by the war and having the cinematic.
Draft Morning by the Byrds with the Fireside Theater doing all the war sounds.
Let me play just a little bit of the chorus here just to, so we can hear all the big cellos and things. Yeah, very sort of 1968, 1972 sort of big Beatles-y effect there. Yeah, any thought about building up, starting with the rolling snare? We're going to really roll in. So this is, last song didn't need a chorus. This one has a chorus. It's like a big beer-raising, again, for something so depressing, it's a little jolly. It's catchy.
A little bit. I mean, it's you've laid it out who the guy is. You've laid it out and you've laid out who's telling the story. It's almost like the parents saying, don't mention the war. Just a reminder. And it's like this, because if you do, all musical hell is going to break loose behind you with horns and snares and guitars and what have you. And it's been pretty gentle up until that point. There's a cacophony in Uncle Lonnie's head. And it's musical and it's amusical and it's war sounds and it's traffic and it's the television and just everything, you know, the traffic outside. The guy has no escape. And so when you get to that point in the song, it's like that represents the explosion waiting to happen inside of him. And it finally releases, which you want to have, you know, catch and release. So it releases and you can get on with the story. But that's supposed to be a little point where, much with the pressed rolls and the snare drums, you want to feel that tension, because what if you do talk about the war? What's going to happen if you do? Everybody's going to suffer if you do. So just keep a lid on it.
All right, well, we're running nice and long here, so even though there are many other things in this song we could pick out, I want to move to number three. Before I do that, I will just point out the live version that I will link folks to. In fact, I will put in a clip right here, the beginning of the chorus of the live version, because whereas this was the big, all, okay, everything's coming in here, when you've only got a three-piece, your strategy is, let's make this the quiet part, like that it still has the dynamic difference, but you do it through subtlety rather than now we're pulling out all the guns, because there are no guns to pull out when you've got a three-piece.
In the war overseas, and something changed Lonnie inside. So don't mention the war.
Yeah, it's a different way of saddling up the horse, you know, to do it in a three-piece rock band without keyboards. I mean, the keyboards are kind of a deal on that song, the multiple snare drums, you know, but you do what you can do with the instruments that you have presented yourself with, and it's okay. And it, like I say, a good song should be adaptable. I've sung that song solo with a guitar, and it seems to work just fine.
All right, so the third song we're going to play here in full, She Won't Drive in the Rain. It's from the DB's reunion album, Falling Off the Sky, 2012. Toward the end, it is one of those nicely layered, lots of strings, piano transitions, very, thick and pretty, but still a beefy story. It's actually kind of a similar story in that it seems like it's about an elderly person, or, you know, somebody who is not at their peak, let's say that. And how they're adapting to that. You want to say a little about this song and where you're at before we hear it?
Sure. This is actually a true story. It's about my wife, who is not actually elderly.
Okay. That's me misreading.
I am 18 years her senior. But when I was on tour with Hootie and the Blowfish, Hurricane Katrina happened in New Orleans. And my wife had taken my daughter and our son and my daughter's friend and had taken the train from New Orleans to Birmingham, where she was to take possession of a Volkswagen Westphalia camper that she'd purchased online. And so by the time they got to Birmingham, it became rather obvious that they were not going to be able to head back to New Orleans because the storm was coming in. And so she packed the kids into the Westie and started heading toward her grandmother's townhouse in Little Rock, Arkansas. The van broke down about an hour away, and in the middle of the night, and there certainly aren't a lot of Volkswagen repair places in rural Alabama that are open after midnight. And so she was able to get to a church shelter, and they stayed there. The kids were, you know, trying to look at it as fun. It was an adventure. My son was really little. My daughter was pretty little, too. The next morning, when it became obvious that there was not going to be a Volkswagen repairman even open in the daylight hours, the minister sold my wife a van that he had. He had a van that he was getting rid of anyway. And I was making money out on the road with Hootie and the Blowfish. That was my job as their keyboard player and utility player. So we're like, just do it. Just get that, you know. And so then she drove the kids across the storm path and like chain smoking cigarettes and, you know, just trying to get there, and got to Little Rock eventually, and then just needed to kind of start heading back. And so dropped my daughter's friend off with her mom in Memphis, dropped my daughter off with my daughter's mom in Franklin, Tennessee, and then drove with my son up to Baltimore from there, where Hootie was playing, and she was going to spend the night, and then her dad was going to come down from Pennsylvania and drive her up to Pennsylvania, because obviously nobody was going back to New Orleans for the time being. So it is a true story, and my wife is my hero for having done that. And I still look at her with total amazement at some of the things that she's done. And that really ranks as probably the most incredible thing she ever did, and saved our family, you know, so that we could be buried. We just celebrated our 22nd anniversary. So now we've gotten a long time to really enjoy that. That's a true story, you know? I mean, that's, I don't mind driving in the rain. That is what I'm here for, you know? That frustration and all that was going on with trying to communicate with people during Katrina, when the phones were all down, all the cell service was down, and we finally learned about text messaging, and that was the only way anybody was ever able to get in touch with anybody. It was so frustrating and overwhelming.
Screen door frames her silhouette. Outside it's dark gray, getting wet. She has one more, one last cigarette. And it's time to leave, but she's not leaving yet. She won't drive in the rain anymore. Buys things twice at the grocery store. Keeps a hatchet on the attic floor, just in case she can't drive till the world runs out. You gotta keep those children smiling. She's gotta know what she's heading toward. She won't drive in the rain anymore. And everyone she turned to for grace spread out across so many states. What she'd give to see just one face would understand she had plans, and the plans just had to change. All it took was that much rain. It never rained that. Heavens open wide. She watches it all from safe inside. It's so different when you are home and dry. And she watches that part of her life flip by. She sees herself at the wheel of the van, crossing the storm path as fast as they can. Midnight somewhere in Alabama, past Birmingham, and she drove till the miles ran out of road, to a place she felt unknown. But you know.
All right. So again, quickly reinterpreting the entire lyrical thing, because it's interesting. So it's a very vivid story, but yet the fact that I could be reading it, and most people don't read it in front of them, and fundamentally misunderstand and project, you know, I'm engaging in lots of elder care these days. And so having somebody who buys things twice and who is steadily losing, like, I won't drive in the rain anymore. Oh, now I won't drive at all. Now it's sort of gradually losing function is sort of what I was reading into this, which there were, of course, some things about being out on the road and reaching out to people for help across the country that didn't, you know, seem more idiosyncratic than that. So very interesting story. So was this written specifically for the DBs, or this is just something you had?
This is a song I had the beginnings of at the end of a Hootie tour. And after that, I actually went out for a few dates with the band Sugarland, because their bass player, Annie Clements, is a dear friend of mine for many, many years. And she suggested that I could sub for Brendan Bush, who is Christian Bush's brother. And Brendan had actually played some stuff with the DBs. So it was sort of like, I'd love to try to do that. And I wasn't very good in the band. I didn't really work out for those two dates. Fortunately, it was only two dates. But in the midst of it all, I brought this song to Christian and I said, maybe this is a song. Is this a song? Should we look at this? Could we look at this together? Just thinking, you know, he writes really great songs and he writes a different kind of song. And I wanted to write a different kind of song. I never really anticipated this being a DB song, to be perfectly honest. And truth to tell, I don't think it's really representative of the band. I think that it definitely does not have a DB's vibe to it. Even that version of it doesn't really feel like the DB's, because there's so much like cinematic string section that Chris put on it. Again, I can play this live with a guitar and a capo, and I can play it, and it's very effective, and people can hear the words. I mean, there's this version of it that's got a lot of bells and whistles all over it. That's cool, too, if people like that sort of thing. Again, it's one of those songs where it's like the guy said when they dropped me from EMI Publishing, your songs are too personal. This is a very personal song. And I love it. I could sing it all day long. I could never say thank you enough to my wife. So this song will sort of have to, this song, and there's another song on the new record called She and Me, which I realized that I hadn't written many love songs to her. So I'd probably better do something about it. And it is the song that ends the album Face of 68. And it's probably the most power pop thing on there. But nonetheless, I'm picky about who I write songs about. You know, I can't write them about everybody.
Yeah, well, it's always a question when you have a band reforming of what is the sound? I recall reading an interview with some of the Camper Van Beethoven guys. They had, you know, broken up for 25 years, gotten back together, and they were like, we don't want this to sound exactly like the last album did. We want it to sound like we've all been making music for 25, 30 years since the last album. And what does that get you? And of course, Chris's sound, who I had on the show also, you know, evolved quite a bit since then. I mean, your 1997 solo album, You're Out of the Way, I was just listening to today, and some of those sound exactly like they could be DB's tunes. But of course, this is further down the road, and you've had so much more experience playing with different groups and arranging. Like, it would be surprising if everything sounded, you know, even though that's maybe what the fans want. Like, otherwise, why, you know, why is it a reunion?
I suppose. I don't know. I mean, they got some DB sounding stuff on Falling Off the Sky, I think. I think a song like World to Cry is a very DB sort of song. I think Chris's beautiful song, Before We Were Born, that is a great DB. So that's my kid's favorite song by the DBs, I'll have you know. Not one of Dad's songs, Chris's song. It's fine with them, you know. We just finished touring ostensibly behind these two 42-year-old albums that got re-released. And it was really fascinating to do that. We had this great keyboard player along with us, Wes Lachaud, and he really took pains to make everything sound like the record. And so the horns on Living a Lie were there. The keyboards on all these songs were exactly like they needed to be. The stuff on the first album that was all done on Chris's Ace Tone Top One combo organ, Wes got all that programmed in. So my feeling is that the people that came to these shows in 2024 to hear the DBs do these songs actually got to experience really accurate versions of the songs, which, you know, they wouldn't have heard in 1982 because we were a flimsy live act. We didn't sing very well. We were out of tune all the time. Everything that could go wrong in a DBs live performance usually did. And that was the case for years. And I will say that that 2024 tour was great because everything had a consistency to it. It all sounded right. Everybody played pretty much the same thing night after night, which to me adds a good consistency to it. And I'm glad people got to hear that. You know, it was a great victory lap for sure. But at the same time, it pointed out that how much more do I really want to play 42-year-old songs? I have often posited the idea that the lyrics to Amplifier would be chiseled into my tombstone. I'm basically planning to be buried at sea now, so that doesn't happen. And it's like, it's great. But I also realized a couple of years ago, I did a house concert tour, and I realized that people mostly relate to the first stuff that they heard that you did. In my case, Stance for Decibels and Repercussion.
Well, I heard Like This first, just on the record.
Okay. All right. That's because you're a young whelp. It's a weird way that that happened because the records didn't come out in America. So the only way people heard them was because DJs would bring their own copies in and play them on the college radio stations or the independent stations. Or there'd be somebody like Meg Griffin on the radio station in New York playing on her Saturday morning show, something like that. You know, but it was very under the radar. It wasn't like, you know, there are bands that got airplay, you know, from our generation of bands. The DBs really didn't, you know. Sound of Music got to like 197 in the Billboard charts one week and then was never heard from again. So the idea of making that mark with people is great, but the idea of being able to bring them along with you to the person who's writing songs in 2022, 2024, 25, you want them to hopefully like what you're doing now because it's what you're doing now. It's how you're feeling now. It's what you're writing about now. You may have changed your perspective from the 22-year-old power pop guy on the streets of New York to the middle-class, ersatz retired guy living in a house in Durham, North Carolina. Things change. Everything's supposed to change. I don't want to force any audience members to listen to stuff that they don't like, and they're not going to. But I also hope that by dint of having been fans of mine from the bands and the records that I've made, that they'll have a pretty open mind to try the Face of 68 and see if it doesn't appeal to them on some visceral level or so.
Sure. Yes. No, I think the new album is definitely close enough to many of the things you've done before and the things that people like about you. There's no reason people would say this is crazy. I guess one more question about She Won't Drive in the Rain. At least if it's a DB's record, it's the two of you harmonizing, but it didn't sound either. Chris is so exact in following you, or it sounds more like you just harmonized yourself. Is that sort of the default? Because it's easy. You don't have to teach somebody the part. You can just friggin' lay it down.
No, you can, but then you miss having somebody else's voice on.
Uh-huh.
I just did a session with somebody this weekend, and he was starting to kind of produce my vocals, and he said, well, I pronounced this word like this, and you missed the attack of the T in this word. And I'm like, listen, I know. It's okay. I said, you've called me in to sing on this, and if you want somebody to sing exactly like you, you should sing exactly like you. I'm going to put a little bit of myself into this, and I don't think that the producer is going to be miserable that I have done that. He will have something to work with, and it will sound just fine. I'm not even sure if I have a copy of Falling Off the Sky at this point. It's been a while since I've listened to it. I may well have done the harmonies to that myself, but I'm not positive. But I'll give it a listen and let you know.
Well, we're probably even already at the point where if somebody doesn't like the part that you wants you to have sung on the record, but doesn't think that what you did is exact enough. Of course, they can always, if you put the T in the wrong place, that's what Pro Tools is for. You can just line everything up just exactly right. So it sounds that I do that myself with other people that sing, but I do think about these things that I hear on YouTube now of, look, it's Paul McCartney singing Elton John's song, but with all of Elton John's cadences, because they took like the Paul McCartney, whatever that set of data is from everything he ever sung. And now you can have the tone of Paul McCartney, but sung exactly the shape that you want. So if they want to have as if Peter came into their session, but have it so exact with their vocal, well, there you go. The technology is mere days away. You just have to send you some money for the for the use of the sample.
Yeah, yeah. All the AI stuff that's being like informed by previously recorded stuff is so frustrating because it just makes it the lines blur even further.
All right. Well, I'm going to take that as permission so that I can do that with your voice for my next album.
Feel free to. If you have a hit, let me know and I'll escort you to the bank.
I don't have the patience or the technology for such things that young folks use. Thanks so much for doing this. Let's to say goodbye, I just wanted to introduce one more song. Where Does the Time Go from Continental Drifters from Better Day 2001. It seems like it's different enough than everything else we've had on here.
Most of the songs that people have heard that I have recorded are songs that were written on guitar, as you might imagine, or bass. Where Does the Time Go is one of a couple, I think, that I wrote on piano that anybody's ever heard. I mean, I've got scores of songs that I wrote on piano, but I just never show them to anybody because I never think that they're very good. But that one, I don't know. That just seemed like something that would be a nice way to close out a Drifters record and accidentally close out the Drifters. So glad you like it. I love playing that song. That's one I wish that the Drifters had played more often. But glad we're going to get to hear it.
Yeah, leading further into the piano jazz, the Dr. John-esque, this gospel sort of feeling. A lot of good stuff. A lot of variety in the catalog, all held together by your wonderful sense of melody and irony and all that stuff. So thanks so much for coming on here. This has been a number of years. I've interviewed several people that are just adjacent to you. You know, two other people that toured with REM. But glad we finally connected.
6 degrees of Peter Holzapfel, like I said. All right, Mark. Thanks so much.
Look at the time, where did it go? How did it get so late again? 5:45, what do you know? Let's call this evening to an end. Where do I go? What do I say when I really wanna stay? And where does the time? Look at my face, look at my tears, look at me laughing it off. Facing the facts, facing my fears, listening to magic and laws. Everything's good, even the pain. Time heals all wounds again and again. And where does the time go? Where does the time go? Where did the time go? Turn the clock back. How could I not see? When did the glass crack? Where did the time go? Where did the end come? To the last road. Where did the time go? Oh, oh, oh. I should have known when each of the last road. Where did the time? Look at the time, I really should run. A whole day of work yet to be done. And nothing I say, and nothing I feel are half as real as you. Nobody knows, nobody sees, no one but you here and me. does the time go? Where does the time go? Where does the time
go? Thanks so much to Peter. A very interesting thinker, as well as a player and singer. So my favorite kind of guest. In keeping with that, he does not actually have a normal website. Instead, you can find him talking a lot and talking about his music at halfpairblog.blogspot.com. He does also have a Bandcamp page with a couple things on it, and you can learn about him on Wikipedia or just look him up on your favorite streaming service. I'm a big DBs fan. His acoustic albums with Chris Stamey are great. And as he said, the DBs were very influenced by Big Star, by Alex Chilton. There's even an album on the streaming services, half with songs by Alex Chilton and half with songs by Peter. Now, I will link to some various performances and other projects that Peter participated in from the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or of course, patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. For a very small recurring fee, you can get my notes for the episodes, which have all the lyrics, have the structures, have a lot of comments about the arrangement that I found important, many of which I don't get to during the interview. So it might be a fun way of continuing to visit these songs. So as you probably noticed, I'm continuing on a every 3 or 4 week release schedule for these. I'm finding that is a comfortable way to fit in all the work that I want to do. I have since, talking to Peter here, talked to Dean Wareham, best known for his work with the bands Luna and Galaxy 500. Another great talker, very smart guy, had some philosophy studying in his background. So look out for that episode within the next 3 to 4 weeks. And I've got some other great interviews that I am researching that I have on the schedule or I'm trying to get on the schedule, but I will wait until I actually have them saved to my hard drive before I tell you who it is. Hope you're all doing well. I'm happy to say personally that my band that had basically broken up in November has reformed in a much smaller acoustic lineup and is sounding great and energizing me, and I should have more recordings from them certainly within the next few months. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.